Well, I would like to say that my choice of the sermon was part of some grand master plan that has been going on for the past 3 or 4 months. But as you know, we've been covering the church eras of Revelation chapter 2 and 3. And it just seemed appropriate, since we're on the fifth church or the Sardis era of church, I think it should become obvious as to why this, even though it's not a part of a grand master plan, it's really not, it's certainly appropriate to cover it at this particular time after we've just gotten back from the Feast of Tabernacles to cover this very important era of the Church of God. I was probably within the first 6 months of attending services in Hagerstown, Maryland with Worldwide Church of God in 1972 when I met a young man who was from southern Pennsylvania who had come down from the Harrisburg Church, or it may have been the Uniontown, Pennsylvania Church. In fact, now that I think about it, I think this visitor was from the Uniontown. We used to have a church in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. I think that may have been more or less western Pennsylvania at the time, but I could be wrong. But I had not met this individual yet, and by that time, after 6 months, I'd met, because the people were so friendly, I'd met everybody in the church and knew most of them and been attending Spokesman's Club and, got to know a lot of the men at that in that particular venue as well. But at any rate, as we were talking, as the custom of the day was, people would ask, at least I would ask, because I heard a lot of stories in the first 6 months about how people came, how people came to the Church of God. And this individual's answer puzzled me at first because I was so new to the church. He simply said, "My family came out of the Sardis era." Well, I really didn't know what the Sardis era was at that particular time. Later, I would find out what his answer meant as I accumulated more knowledge. And then in the fall of that year, late summer of that year, went over to England to Ambassador College and began to know a little bit more about the church and the history of the church. And certainly during those years, I was reading the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong, to which I recommend to anybody that's new. If you want to get a feeling for what we're all about today, and give you a feeling of his introduction to the Church of God, which is certainly pertinent to what I'm talking about today. And I think it's very important that we understand this history and that we understand the eras of God's church. Obviously, that's the reason I dedicated an entire series to it. Well, I was reading, or later on would begin to read, the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong, and he wrote about his own experience in coming to the Church of God. And most of you know the story, but for those of you who don't know the story, that in the mid-20s, about 1927, Mr. Armstrong was challenged in his own mind as to what day was the day that should be kept according to the Bible. And his wife had met a next-door neighbor, a Mrs. Runcorn, who happened to be a member of the Church of God, Seventh Day. And back in the 20s, there were various pocket groups of the Church of God, Seventh Day, the group that we have come to know as the Sardis era of the Church of God, or this fifth installment of the Church of God in Revelation chapter 3. Mr. Armstrong told his wife that she was basically nuts for thinking that Saturday was the day to be kept, because she wanted to go to church on Saturday. And he said, "Well, what would you go to church on Saturday for? All these other churches are going on Sunday. And since virtually everybody is going to church on Sunday, they can't all be wrong." And so she said, "Well, the Sabbath is the day that we should keep, and that's the day I'm going to keep it." And the challenge was that he was determined to find out that his wife was wrong about the Sabbath. And so he set out to prove that people should go to church on Sunday like all the Christian churches were doing. And she said, "You know, I've proven it to myself." So he began this intensive night and day study of the Bible. And at the conclusion of, or at the first part of the conclusion of the matter, he found out that he couldn't prove his wife wrong. And so he had to join her because he realized that once he proved it, that he had to do it for himself. Through the years, since I've been in the church since 1972, my baptism, I understood that in the 20th century, those that we felt and that we identified with Sardis didn't really like that portrayal or that title or that label applied to them. And the Worldwide Church of God and Herbert Armstrong had applied and had figured out that the group that he came in contact with in 1927 was indeed the one that the Apostle John speaks about as being Sardis. But they didn't like it. They didn't really like it at all. Now, later on, through my ministry, my own ministry, I would meet some of the modern-day leaders of that church, Church of God, Seventh Day. And I will faithfully record today the impressions of that meeting, which I think certainly dovetail with the prophecies of this era of the Church of God. So before we go any further into the history of this era, and for context, all the other sermons, Thyatira, Pergamos, Ephesus, all the rest are in a series. They're on the website, and you can listen to those. So from a contextual standpoint, that is often helpful, and it's very, very difficult to cram all of this information into one sermon, and there's more available about this era than any of the others because it's closer to our recent past. It's closer in terms of its history, and there are more records than available about this group than any other just because of the proximity of time. So let's go to Revelation chapter 3. And let's read what Christ says about this era of the Church of God. And as you're reading and as we're going through the message today, remember that this church was, is God's church. And we can prove that not all Christian churches throughout history have been God's church. There are certain standards and tests that must be applied. We won't go through all of them today. But the first one is mentioned prominently in terms of Christ's admonition to this particular church era. Now, I mentioned before that the church at various times of Thyatira knew who they were. Later they became known at the latter end of their particular era, and it said that the last works of Thyatira were more than the first. They had a college. They had a ministerial training program. They had an emblem. The Waldensian Church, or the Church of God, had an emblem with seven stars at the top picturing the seven churches of Revelation, and the bright shining flame pointed to the middle of that little oval type of emblem. There are many of them that you can find. Points to the fourth star, the fourth church of Revelation. Those people knew who they were. They knew that they were the church of God, even though others later on called them by the Lollards or the Waldensians or whomever. And they had various leaders, some of them very powerful, some of them great teachers. And all of this is pertinent to understanding the history of the church of Sardis as well. So to the angel of the church of Sardis write, these things says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works, that you have a name, that you are alive, but you are dead. At various times in the history of the era of Sardis, they were known to the world by other names. Seventh-day Baptists, Anabaptists, Anabaptists, meaning rebaptizers, because they did not believe in infant baptism, just as the church in Thyatira did not believe in infant baptism. And they were categorized in that way by the world and called Anabaptists or rebaptizers because they believed in adult decision making at baptism. They did not baptize children as the Roman church had done, and then all the Protestant churches as well had done. It says, "Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God." When you read through the admonitions given to the church at Sardis, these admonitions are as great as any of the churches of the seven. "Remember, therefore, how you have received and heard, hold fast and repent." They did something wrong. They did something they shouldn't have done, at least through the history. And I trace the history. Others have traced the history. I'm just reading what others have done. I'll get to that in a bit. From the time of, and there is some overlap in these groups, of course, but just for round figures, about the beginning of the 17th century or the 1600s. Again, with some overlap. "Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief, and you will not know what hour I will come upon you, and you have a few names, even in Sardis, who have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So when we examine this, Christ says about their works that they had a name, and most of the time that I have discovered in researching this and looking at the history of the Sardis era, you can find groups that are known by the Church of God at various times from the 1600s all the way up into the 20th century. Christ said, "Be watchful, strengthen the things that remain which are ready to die. Your works are not perfect before God. Remember," very important, "remember how you received and heard." When you understand the history of what happened to these people, this comment by Christ, or this admonition from Christ, makes a lot of sense. "You will not know what hour I will come upon you. A few names only have not defiled garments." So it appears as though the track record of the Sardis church was that there are only a few who remained faithful throughout the ages. What does history record and teach us of this fifth era of God's church? And what are the lessons today that we can learn from this era and these warnings? That is probably the most important thing to remember about the sermon today. What are the lessons that we can apply to ourselves? Because remember, Christ said, listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. There is meaning for those of us who consider ourselves Philadelphian. Or maybe some don't. Maybe some think that this is the Laodicean era. It doesn't matter. We can't always identify every single aspect in the present time. I'm sure that many of these folks did not understand these admonitions as clearly as they could have at the time had they done something that they could have done. Of what importance was the geographic area of Sardis? That's one of the questions we'll answer today. What was the geographical significance? Is there anything that we can take from that and apply it in a symbolic way to the people of Sardis through the, 300 or so years of this particular era? Who do we believe was the Sardis era? When did it begin? Well, I've kind of answered that question a little bit. Is Sardis still here today? Is the church identified as the Sardis era still here today? And what about these admonitions by Jesus Christ? What does it mean that their name projected life, but they were actually dead? Why were they encouraged to be watchful, to strengthen the things that remain which are ready to die? Why were their works not perfect before God? And importantly, why were they told to remember how they had received the truth and how they had heard it, and that to bring that back to memory? The title of the sermon is The Neglect of Sardis. The Neglect of Sardis. Now, before I continue, I would like to cite and credit the work of the following faithful men and ministers. I'm assuming that all of them have been faithful, so who through the 20th and 21st centuries have chronicled the history of the true Church of God. I am just, and all of us are just the recipient of their work, and some of the names may surprise you. There was first the seminal work by Andrew Duggar and Clarence Dodd, who were early leaders in the 20th century of the Church of God Seventh Day, until there was a split in, I believe it was 1933, between Clarence Dodd and Andrew Duggar, which resulted in the formation of Clarence Dodd organizing what we know as the Sacred Names Movement in Salem, West Virginia. The Church of God Seventh Day had a headquarters from the early 1900s in Stanbury, Missouri. It was transferred from a town, I can't remember the name of the town in Iowa, but to Stanbury, Missouri. That's where the headquarters was until this split of this particular group of men happened who had been colleagues. But Clarence Dodd went off and led the Sacred Names Movement, which has been an argument that has captured people through the years, in which they think that there's a certain way that God's name must be pronounced, and et cetera, et cetera. That sprung out of Salem, West Virginia. But I would like to cite them and credit them for their work and their research, both of them, in cataloging and chronicling the history of the Church of God. And they did a very good job of identifying the church eras. And the Church of God Seventh Day, by the way, at one time believed and taught that there were seven eras of the Church of God, but that fell into disfavor along with the teaching of prophecy later on. Certainly, Herbert Armstrong, incredible research, and brought to life the things that we know, certainly about his own experience in contact with the Church of God Seventh Day. In addition, certainly very important in the history of the people of God, Mr. Tannert brought his name to my attention several years ago, G.G. Rupert, who I'm not going to pigeonhole into the Sardis era of the Church of God, because some of these times overlap. We look at the, generally speaking, we look at the origin of the Philadelphia Church of God at about 1933, after Mr. Armstrong's acceptance into the ministry. Perhaps there was a Philadelphian influence some 20 years prior to his time in the ministry under the name of G.G. Rupert and others. Also, a very good historian, church historian, although he's never part of United Church of God, I don't think, Richard Nickel, who did an outstanding job through the last few years of his life, maybe the last several decades of his life, in cataloging the history of the true Church of God and the people of God. Certainly also Herman Hay, who was an incredible scholar, an incredible intellect, who did a lot of work. Dean C. Blackwell, who was a mentor of mine when I was in college. And then here's a name that maybe some of you have long forgotten, but the original writer of the 58-lesson correspondence course, an incredible teacher, an incredible writer, and an incredible author, C. Paul Meredith, who was the uncle of the more familiar Dr. Roderick Meredith, who died last year, living Church of God. A gentleman, I don't know if he's in the ministry, by the name of Bob Thiel, who kind of has categorized a lot of this information into one website, and he claims to be a part of what is what he calls the continuing Church of God. I don't know the man, but what he has done has been pretty good, pretty accurate in consolidation. And then a very personal mentor of mine, Mr. John O'Gwynn. John O'Gwin was the first minister that I worked with when I was sent out as a ministerial trainee in 1975. And I was sent to South Texas, where I met the lovely Terry, and we began our family a year later, or 2 years later, but we began as a family, as a couple, a year later. We were married in 1976. But a few words about John O'Gwin, who was an incredible preacher. He performed our wedding ceremony. Unfortunately, met an untimely death in 2005 after a trip to Africa for Living Church of God, contracted some kind of disease that he could never shake, and died from it. But in his lifetime, John O'Gwin was, voice starts to crack a little bit thinking of it, but we would leave at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sabbath and go down to the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, 160 miles one way, for church services at 9:30. John would give a powerful sermon, usually at least an hour and a half, and then we would have services at 3 o'clock in the afternoon back in Corpus Christi, Texas. And he had incredible energy, John did. But he'd give two sermons a day on every Sabbath. We'd either do that circuit or we'd go to Victoria, Texas, which was about 90 miles north of Corpus Christi. And, you know, I was the second man. I was, you know, sometimes the family would go. Sometimes they would meet us at the church hall back when we'd meet. But I remember John's notes would be one page of scriptures. We don't do that now. I don't know if he did that for his entire life, but this was before computers. But John would organize his sermon, introduction, SPS, body, conclusion. He would have all his scriptures on one page. He would speak for an hour and a half. And his sermon in the morning and in the afternoon were almost always word for word identical. And so we're talking about somebody who's speaking basically off the cuff, except for reading the scriptures. And his commentary was never written down. He had an incredible memory. He was a great researcher. He was a great teacher. He was a great writer. So all of these individuals have contributed to this. And I put that up front so that I don't have to cite each and every one, because a lot of the information is overlapping. A lot of it came from Duggar and Dodd. And, you know, a lot of the others have simply combined some of the history into articles. And, you know, my eyes are bleary-eyed from reading about this particular era of the church. As the light of day of the 16th century emerges, there is a more authenticated history, perhaps, of this era than any of the previous four, because due to the fact that, for the most part, the Inquisition, the Spanish and other Inquisitions were over, you know, we went through the distasteful time of the people of Thyatira and found that, you know, the people who were intolerant of religious freedom had a thing about burning people at the stake. And a lot of people were hung and burned at the stake through the Middle Ages. It was a horrible time and a very challenging time to be a member of the Church of God, or to have an attitude of doing something different than the rest of Christianity. They weren't very, very tolerant. And at the beginning of this era of the Church of God, there still wasn't that kind of tolerance, as we're going to see. After a while, religious tolerance grew and expanded, and the Sardis era didn't have as many problems in the latter stages as it did in the earlier part of its development. So there's a lot of information that is more readily available about this particular era of the church. The printing press was making advantage of the printed word. Books and the Bible were being distributed and became more available as time went on. So let's briefly comment on the city of Sardis, because I think that, at least for me, there's more symbolism regarding this city and the church era itself from looking at the city and its positioning and how it is mirrored within the history of the Sardis era of the church. Sardis was founded in the 12th century before Christ. It's one of the oldest cities and most important cities of Asia, or at least it was at that particular time. It's kind of non-existent now. Remember, these cities were located in a clockwise fashion, from Ephesus and kind of around the Horn. And it was about 35 miles southeast of Thyatira. And it was thought to be an impregnable city because it was located way above, about 1,500 feet above the plain. And it was so elevated that they could see virtually all around them. And so any enemy that would attack this city was going to have a tough time overthrowing it. But indeed, it was overthrown by Cyrus in 549 BC. It had been an ancient city even at that time, but Cyrus, who overthrew Babylon, was able to overthrow Sardis. And Sardis was the capital of the kingdom of Lydia. Of course, this was all Greek, right? And it also fell in AD 395. The Lydians were one of the richest of the kingdoms of the ancient world. They are reputed to have been the inventors of coined money, and there was a kind of a sandy creek or riverbed in which they mined gold. And from there, they had a great deal of wealth. The historian Ridpath says, a great cause of the prosperity and wealth of the Lydian kingdom was the natural fertility of the country. No other of all of Asia Minor had so rich a soil. So it was in a perfect place to defend, but it was overthrown twice, basically because the people became overconfident and they became complacent of the positioning of their city and thought that nobody could possibly overthrow them, and yet they were. And the later individuals who inhabited the city were ignorant and stayed willfully ignorant, I guess, of the previous overthrow by Cyrus because they were overthrown once again. The point is that the city itself, the ancient city of Sardis, failed to maintain a watch. Now, there's a lot of other intricate detail about how it was captured. The Persians overthrew it in a very similar way as to how they overthrew Babylon. You know, they remember how they diverted the Euphrates River, and in 539 were able to overthrow Babylon because they crept in unawares in the middle of the night on the dry riverbed because the river had been diverted, and then they surprised the Babylonians. Well, in the same way, they kind of did that to Sardis when they overthrew Sardis. They got complacent. The legend has it that a soldier of Sardis dropped his helmet down kind of a ravine, and this was noticed by some of the Persian soldiers because there is seemingly no way up these steep cliffs to get into the city. But this soldier dropped his helmet. He was on watch, and then he went down to get it, and he didn't see the Persian soldiers, who saw how he scampered back up, and that's how they entered the city, and they overthrew the city. They had failed to watch. Now, again, as I mentioned, the origin of the Sardis era is traced back to the early 1600s by most of the individuals that I've cited as historians. One of the early leaders of the Church of God in England was an individual by the name of John Trakke. He was arrested for teaching about the Sabbath and imprisoned. I think basically for the rest of his life, he may have recanted his beliefs and was later let out. So you can see that the Inquisition era had not yet totally ended at the beginning of the Sardis era of the Church of God. Following him in 1661 was a minister by the name of John James. Now, the inventiveness of how you put somebody to death is really kind of gut-wrenching. This individual is also arrested and persecuted, tortured, quartered and pulled apart. His heart was taken out and burned. I don't know what they thought that did somehow, maybe kill his soul. But that's what happened to him for doing the same thing, teaching about the truth of God and the Sabbath day. Ivor Fletcher, a historian of the Church of God that I haven't yet mentioned, wrote, in his work, The Incredible History of God's True Church, that in his final words to the court, this is John James, he simply asked him to read the following scriptures from Jeremiah 26, Psalm 116, and after his execution, his head was taken out and burned, and the four quarters of his body fixed to the gates of the city, and his head set up on a pole in Whitechapel opposite to the alley in which his meeting house stood. Such was the horrible price that some were prepared to pay for obedience to God in the 17th century England. Now, obviously, you don't allow yourself to go through this unless you really believe something. Belief comes from understanding. True belief of the Bible comes from understanding. Putting your life on the line is not something you're going to do lightly, and something, in most cases, these men did not recant their faith, but they, as Hebrews 11 shows, they died for their beliefs, and their ideas were formulated, of course, by the teaching of God and the Bible and the church of God that convinced them that the things that we do today are right and true and proper and appropriate, like keeping the Sabbath day holy and going to the Feast of Tabernacles and understanding what the plan of God is through understanding the holy day seasons itself. And these individuals did. There is proof that at various times in the Sardis era of the Church of God, some of them were called feet washers because they kept the Passover. At other times, there is some indication that they kept the other holy days of God, especially the Passover and the spring holy days. Prominent at this time in England was the first Sabbath-keeping church in England, which was still known, probably still there today, known as the Mill Yard Church of God. Now, in the New World, the colony, which became a state, Rhode Island, was the only American colony which was founded on the principle of religious liberty. And this is where a convert by the name of Stephen Mumford landed in 1664. And upon his landing in Rhode Island, he associated, first of all, with Sunday-keeping Baptist churches. But he had been touched by the Sabbath keepers of England, and finally formed a congregation of Sabbath keepers in Newport, Rhode Island, beginning in 1671 with seven members. That is where we trace our historical antecedents of the Church of God in the United States. They were known by the world as Seventh-day Baptists. But they thought of themselves as the Church of God that kept the seventh day. Sabbath-keeping churches were also established in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. And I know that we have some experts in Sierra Vista who are attending with us who know a little bit more about the Adventist movement that I do. And so some of this will be a little bit familiar, but please understand that I'm not going to go into great detail today. But in the early 1800s, an individual by the name of William Miller was prominent in another group that kept the Sabbath, who eventually became the Seventh-day Adventist. And they led a movement called the Adventist Movement. And because of his misunderstanding of the 2300-day prophecy in Daniel, he ascribed the date of Christ's return to 1844. And when that, which is known as the Great Disappointment, Christ did not return in 1844 as he surmised, then much of the interest in prophecy among Sabbath keepers began to wane. You can trace it from that particular time. And Mr. Armstrong said that when he came into contact with the small group of people in Salem, Oregon, he was amazed that they could be the Church of God because they had no life in them at all. They didn't have any understanding of prophecy except something that they had borrowed from William Miller and the Seventh-day Adventist group known as the Third Angel's Message. Other than that, in the Church of God Seventh Day, the understanding or the proclamation of Bible prophecy has never been prominent. Never. And to this day, they have basically the Sabbath and the law of God, but very, very little emphasis on Bible prophecy. In 1860, a conference of Sabbath keepers got together with some of these who had become the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they had a publication at that particular time, and they were preaching things about prophecy. But those in the minority were a group that published a paper or a booklet or a magazine called The Hope of Israel, which means that that group at one time understood from whence they came from a genetic standpoint. They understood that in the past there had been promises made to Abraham. That Hope of Israel later became the Bible Advocate, which was published by the Church of God Seventh Day. They were the minority, though. The larger group, and this is what happens through history when you study the history of the true church, whenever you see a large group begin to emerge, it's usually not God's people. That's what happened in the church era of Thyatira, who at one time began to fellowship with certain Protestant denominations, and then, poof, they kind of almost vanish from the face of the earth. Some Sabbath keepers in the 16th century were called Anabaptists, as I mentioned. They taught the doctrine of millennialism, or the kingdom of God for 1,000 years. Where did they get that? I submit to you that they got it because at some point in the history, that understanding of the 1,000-year reign of Christ came from the keeping of the fall feasts. They also believed that God would offer salvation at some point to all mankind. Where did we get that? Where did they get that? I submit that it was very likely coming from the fact that they kept the eighth day, the last day, which pictures that particular time in which all mankind will be offered salvation. In 1745, some of the church congregations of the Church of God later became Seventh-day Baptist. And they went off the rails. You can trace their point when they began to call some of their ministers reverend instead of just elders. Now, there was a Church of God in Piscataway, New Jersey, which called itself the Church of God. And I won't go through all the history of this Piscataway Church of God. But they were organized in Piscataway, New Jersey. Their name is recorded in their first church record book from 1705. And they list articles of faith. I may read some of them just for interest. I can go over them later personally with you if you'd like to look at them. But their record reads, and this is from their own record keeping, "The Church of God, keeping the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ, living in Piscataway and Hopewell, in the province of New Jersey, being assembled with one accord at the house of Benjamin Martin in Piscataway, the 19th of August, 1705. We did then, and with one mind, choose our dearly beloved Edward Dunham, who is faithful in the Lord, to be our elder and assistant according to the will of God, whom we did send to New England to be ordained, who is ordained in the church meeting in Westerly, Rhode Island, by prayer and laying on of hands by their elder, William Gibson, the 8th of September, 1705. So there were certain things that they understood, right? They believed in ordaining into the ministry, the laying on of hands, Hebrews 6. Some of the true people of God understood the meaning of Hebrews 6 and the basic doctrines of the church. And they had several articles that I won't take the time to read through at this particular time, but maybe briefly. "We believe there is one God the Father and one Lord Jesus Christ." Other groups of the Church of God or associated with the Church of God later adopted Trinitarian practices and ideas. They later adopted ideas such as the immortality of the soul. And when you find the true people of God, you'll find that they adopted neither one of those. We believe, point number two, we believe that all scriptures of the Old and New Testament given by inspiration are the Word of God. And they cite a number of scriptures, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19, 20, and 21, 2 Timothy 3, 16. I won't bore you with all the scriptures because I just don't have time to turn to all of them. but they had the truth, these folks. We believe that the Ten Commandments, which were written on two tables of stone by the finger of God, continue to be the rule of righteousness unto all men. And then they quote a number of scriptures. We believe the six principles recorded in Hebrews 6, which I had alluded to just before, to the rule of faith and practice. We believe that the Lord's Supper ought to be administered and received in all Christian churches. These individuals were known as feet washers because they kept the Passover and washed each other's feet. Another other things that they list, but when you read through them, you say, these people believed in the Bible. They believed in all the Bible. These were the people of God. They had the right name. They were called the Church of God, and they called themselves the Church of God, and the world recognizes that they were the Church of God. So I've mentioned about the Adventist movement and who proclaimed the return of Jesus Christ in 1844. It's just a hunch in my part, by the way, that when that prophecy failed, there was very little enthusiasm and for prophecy, and it lost its luster. That and also the introduction of an individual by the name of Ellen G. White, who proclaimed herself to be a prophetess in the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And those prophecies that she had uttered failed as well, and it looks as though, like as some historians feel, there was some kind of either demonic possession or influence in the life of Ellen G. White. At one time, the Church of God Seventh-day believed and taught in the church eras, but they don't do that any longer. Now, let's go to Christ's warning once again in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1. I've given you a lot of information, and I'll just say that the sermon today is not intended to be scripture heavy. I just can't avoid that and give you the same sense of the history and what happened to this group of people, but we're going to go back now and concentrate on these important admonitions and warnings that Jesus Christ gave to this church. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, "And to the angel of the church in Sardis write, these things says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works, that you have a name that you're alive, but you are dead." At various times through their history, this church did very little. From the time of 1860, for instance, for the next 70 years, there is very little accomplished by the Church of God, which became the Church of God Seventh-day. They had the Bible Advocate, but there wasn't much proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ at all. And why would they? When you lose the knowledge of prophecy and you don't believe in that, then there's no immediacy in your life, really. What gives your life an incredible zeal is the understanding that Jesus Christ is going to return to this earth, as we have just rehearsed at the Feast of Tabernacles. And if you don't keep the Feast of Tabernacles, it is very hard. And the Day of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, if you don't keep those days, it is going to be near impossible for you to keep an enthusiasm for the return of Jesus Christ and an understanding of Bible prophecy, because it becomes irrelevant to you, which it did to the era of the Sardis people of the Church of God. They were admonished beforehand, and they were told about this. And I'm going to show that they were warned in the latter stages in the 20th century at least two times of these facts. And they ignored it. They became complacent, just like the city of Sardis did. The overall failure of this era, and that which is important to us, is that despite holding on to the Sabbath, the lack of enthusiasm for the future and what would happen to the church and what would happen to the people, and without a public proclamation of the good news of the coming kingdom of God and the excitement, they would lose it about the kingdom of God. The name that is most often referred to in the Sardis era was the Church of God Seventh Day. That's where my early acquaintance in the Church of God, his family, had come out of that group, because they were touched by the message of Herbert Armstrong and the understanding of Bible prophecy. And as I've said many times in sermons, Billy Graham and a phone hookup by the owner of the department store Harrods in London, thought that these two great theologians should get together on the phone. He arranged a phone conversation. Even if you want to look at it this way, the great evangelist Billy Graham acknowledged to Herbert Armstrong, "Elder Armstrong, I really appreciate your ministry of prophecy. He understood that because it was all over the radio late at night in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. If you were channel surfing on the radio, it was almost impossible on a nightly basis not to get the World Tomorrow broadcast. It was almost impossible not to hear it. It was so saturating the airwaves. Herbert Armstrong's initial contact was the Church of God, Seventh Day. They weren't teaching Bible prophecy except something, as I mentioned, that they'd borrowed from Ellen G. White, the third angel's message, which was bogus. Herbert Armstrong saw that they had some of the truth, especially his next-door neighbor. He saw that they were doing nothing with it, and he couldn't believe the group of uneducated people that he came into contact with in Salem, Oregon, was the true Church of God. Later on, he would begin to understand that it was when he began to understand about the true Church of God, he could identify them as the Sardis era. He had just meant to disprove the Sabbath. Before he was baptized, and he was an interested member of fellowshipping and associating with this small group in Salem, Oregon, there were ministers from the headquarters church in Stanbury, Missouri, who were sent. After asking polite questions, they were very upset and even hostile towards him. Through his ministry, if you'll read through the autobiography, you'll find that most of these men that he tried to team with and work with in the early stages of his ministry could not be trusted. And that is why, and Mr. LaRavia can attest to this. Hi, Mr. LaRavia and Gwen can attest to this fact, that it was very difficult for Mr. Armstrong to put trust in men because of his earlier experience in men who violated that trust. He found out that most of them were in it for themselves, in it for the money, and they could not be trusted. Now, shortly after fellowshipping with the Church of God Seventh Day, Herbert Armstrong wrote articles for the Bible Advocate very early on. But when the Stanbury ministers would come out and found out who he was, his articles were not accepted anymore until an individual in his congregation, who is an elderly man, got very angry and wrote to the Stanbury, Missouri church, and because he was, you know, a tithe payer, they reinstated his articles. In verse 2 of Revelation 3, it says, "Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God." Now, I've mentioned this before, but in a ministerial conference in Detroit, Michigan, that Herbert Armstrong attended with the Church of God Seventh Day and various other groups from around the country of ministers getting together, where they considered various things and articles, Herbert Armstrong proposed two articles. He was presenting this information to the board of 12 apostles of the Church of God Seventh Day, Salem, West Virginia headquarters, and others from Stanbury, Missouri, also met there. Reading from the minutes, which I believe are in the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong, it reads, "May 7th, at 1 p.m., reading of Elder Armstrong's letter to the 12, reading in periods of 20 minutes each, of Elder Armstrong's articles on the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, etc., followed each time by discussion pro and con by the elders. A decision was made, as given in the following resolution. This is the Church of God, Seventh Day. Remember, after being presented with that which you feel so strongly about, you are willing to go to a daily service during the Feast of Tabernacles and the eighth day, still to this day, and you were confronted with this a number of years ago as well. A decision was made, given in the following resolution. Inasmuch as some have troubled the churches, teaching them that they should observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the yearly Sabbaths, troubled. We reaffirm the teachings of the Church of God on this point that we observe no such custom. According to the official records provided by Virginia Royer, bookkeeper of the Church of God Publishing House in Salem, it was in 1938 that Herbert Armstrong was asked to turn in his credentials for continuing to preach contrary to church doctrine. He didn't give up. He went back to his little group. He and his wife had kept the holy days, not knowing what they were all about, not knowing their purpose, but kept them for 7 years before introducing them to a group who had become Radio Church of God after a proclamation campaign was begun in the 30s. People were added. It grew and grew and grew. This church at one time prominently had taught in various periods about millennialism, about the return of Jesus Christ and the setting up of God's kingdom. But that belief and the overall belief in prophecy was dropped almost altogether, along with another paper that was presented at this conference. It was the forerunner of the United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy. That paper was also rejected. It would be the second time in 25 years that both of these concepts, that is, the understanding of the holy days and the understanding of who we are as a nation, who the descendants of Abraham are, if you do not understand those keys to Bible prophecy, the holy days, and who the ancestors of Abraham are, you cannot understand the future, and you are going to be dead, which means asleep, which Sardis basically was. And the message to you today is to understand that if you do not continue in those things, you will also lose what most of Sardis lost. From about 1915 through 1937, the first one being G.G. Rupert and then Herbert Armstrong both presented this information to the Church of God Seventh Day. Some of it was even allowed by Andrew Duggar to be published in the Bible Advocate by G.G. Rupert. You can find him. Richard Nickel has done an outstanding job of categorizing what this Church of God minister from Oklahoma taught. It's just that he died before the advent of radio. There was the printing press, and he wrote volumes of good information. The one connection between G.G. Rupert and Herbert Armstrong was Andrew Duggar. Now, some have speculated that Duggar may have introduced the writings of G.G. Rupert to Herbert Armstrong. I don't know that there's any way of proving that, or if it's just a miracle, or a coincidental miracle that it happened to both individuals. But the key to this is, as we are studying the Sardis era, is the understanding that those precepts were rejected out of hand. And that answers the question, why did Christ admonish them to be watchful? It is our keeping of the annual holy days of God that help us to understand Bible history, because when you begin with the Passover, you begin with the understanding of the nation of Israel, which sprang from Abraham, through the days of unleavened bread, to the new church. 1 Corinthians 5:8, Christ our Passover died for us, right? You're unleavened, etc., helps us to understand who we are as a church. And then the fall holy days help explain the future. If you don't keep them, if you don't understand them, you will lose it. It's happened in our experience, where others have had a Sardis-like experience in their lives. It appears as though at various times in the Sardis era that they kept the Passover, and other groups of God's people through the 16th and 19th centuries kept the holy days. G.G. Rupert's small group in Oklahoma did, as well as keeping the Sabbath day. So Mr. Armstrong always thought that the Philadelphian era of the Church of God began in 1933. Well, it's possible there was a forerunner of that in the early 1900s, because G.G. Rupert went of all places to Pasadena, California in the early 1900s and conducted 70 Bible campaigns from his base in Pasadena, California. Incredible. Note Luke 21 and verse 36. Sorry to get choked up a little bit over that. It's amazing. Luke 21 and verse 36. Christ says, "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass." One of the Mount Olivet prophecies about the return of Jesus Christ and stand before the Son of Man. So when are we to do this? When are we to watch and pray always? Is it going to be just prior to Christ's imminent return? That's too late. When do we watch and pray always? Every day of your life. You're motivated to do that because of your knowledge of Bible history and Bible prophecy and who the people of Abraham are. One of the things that the holy days teach us is the plan of salvation, so that we always eagerly anticipate and always look forward to and watch the return of Jesus Christ. Ourselves, our own spiritual condition, the spiritual condition of the Sardis era is that which is being questioned by Jesus Christ and his admonitions. Now this feast, I'll tell you what, if you were in Steamboat Springs, you heard several calls to action about what it means to be a Christian and what you need to do. In verse 3 of Revelation 3, it says, "Remember, therefore, how you have received and heard. Hold fast and repent. Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief, and you'll not know what hour I come upon you." How had they received the truth? Well, if you've listened to the last, if you were here for the last on the series of Thyatira, you know how they heard the truth. They heard it from the previous era. They heard it from the Lollards and the Waldensians, who preserved the knowledge of the truth, and then it was transitioned, the baton was passed to them. These were the individuals who were burned to the stake because of their beliefs. These were the individuals that loved not their lives to the death. The early leaders of Sardis were also persecuted and put to death for their beliefs, as we've covered. Again, it is impossible to know the times or the seasons if you're not keeping the holy days of God. And that is what is important as we return from the feast and this first Sabbath for all of us. The holy days propel us, help us to anticipate the future return of Jesus Christ, and encourage us to always be watchful and strengthen the things that remain. Verse 4, "You have a few names, even in Sardis, who have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy." And that ought to be obvious as well. "He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Christ warned this church of their spiritual lethargy and drowsiness and sleep, and told them the danger was that he would come upon them as a thief. I'm going to skip ahead. I've got a lot of information. I just don't have time to give it to you now. The instructions that Jesus Christ gives to Sardis are universal instructions for God's people throughout the ages. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. In December of 1994, a conference of West Coast ministers, most of them employed ministers, of which I was one, were called to Santa Barbara, California. To this conference, the organizers had invited representatives of the Church of God Seventh Day, which at that time and now has been headquartered in Denver, Colorado, for some years. Why were these men called to a conference of Worldwide Church of God ministers? Well, it was apparent as weeks leading up to it and during the conference, it was done to appease those individuals for their group being called Sardis by Herbert Armstrong, who had died some 8 years previous. The organizers of the conference, which became the leaders of Worldwide Church of God, we later learned, had grown through their young lifetimes to hate the teachings of Herbert Armstrong and were determined to change the things that that church would do, like keeping the Sabbath, which was revealed to us at that particular conference, such as keeping the holy days, which we were given clues to at that particular conference. At lunch one day, we were seated at a 10-seat round table, and there were three representative ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day from Denver, Colorado, who appeared to be leaders of that particular group. They published the Bible Advocate still, which I don't read it very often, but sometimes it still has some good articles, I think. Along with me and these three other representative ministers of Church of God Seventh Day were several other younger ministers of the Worldwide Church of God. I didn't consider myself young then, even though I was only 42 at the time. Now I'd be one of the youngest ministers in the ministry, right? And actually, now I am still one of the youngest ministers in the ministry. Okay. During lunch, I asked those three ministers if any of them have ever had contact with Herbert Armstrong. I was surprised by their attitude. Actually, it was one of contempt toward the man and scoffing. The oldest of the three ministers even remarked, "Oh, Herb," in a despondent cry. Because of the attitude that infiltrated Worldwide Church of God and the constant message that disparaged the work of Herbert W. Armstrong, unfortunately, one or two of the younger ministers of Worldwide Church of God joined in with the condemnation of Herbert Armstrong. I was furious. I looked around the table, and I challenged anyone who was sitting there to show me anyone in all of religion who had built a work from nothing in the Great Depression to an annual income of over $200 million a year. And whether anybody had ever done that in the 20th century besides Herbert Armstrong. There was awkward silence because I was angry. I folded up my napkin, had just touched my salad, and left the conversation. I don't think I took my napkin in contempt and threw it down on the table, but I feel like I should have done that. Christ closes his admonition to Sardis with, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." In light of how closely aligned this era is to our present day, and there is still a Church of God Seventh Day in a magazine called the Bible Advocate, it would be good to remember that anyone in any era can be spiritually dead. Keeping the Sabbath, the holy days, and the laws of God, just doing them, going through the motions, doesn't guarantee your endurance to the end. Staying close to God, watching your own spiritual condition by being responsive to the correction of God and His law will. In addition, as we'll find in the next installment in several weeks, the greatest promises given by God to one man, Abraham, would include many of his descendants. And knowing who those people are help us to understand Bible history and Bible prophecy. Both of these doctrines were rejected and held in contempt at several times during the era known as Sardis. For those who are still motivated by the Spirit of God, and to all of us in the Church of God today, may God continue to grant us repentance and forgiveness until the return of Jesus Christ.